The boys killing the world to face some challenges. The American Society of Magical Negroes told us there's still tomorrow. And the ordinary angels meeting a scary girl. I'm Van Connor.
And I'm Adam Ball, and this is Off Screen, your 7-day guide to everything movies.
Boom.
Groovy. So, hello and welcome back to Off Screen then. We have got a load of brand new movies to talk about today with Van, who of course has seen them all already. So, we are going to look at There's Still Tomorrow, Ordinary Angels, Boy Kills World, all very soon. But in our first block today, we're going to look at Scary Girl, and we will start with the American Society of Magical Negroes. I remember you mentioning this last week when we did our little bit at the end about what we're looking forward to. And I can't remember for the life of me what the aim of the movie is.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the movie can't half the time, but that's burying the lead there. Right, so we've also got to talk about this and Scary Girl in this box. I've got to kind of compress a lot of thoughts into a very small amount of time. This was not the movie I thought it was, and wow, this is... I want to meet the mind that cooked this up. So are you aware of the quote-unquote magical Negro trope? As it was called.
No, never heard of it.
Right. It is a term used to describe a very specific kind of African-American character in popular fiction. Now, I've heard it used to describe Will Smith's character in The Legend of Bagger Vance, for instance. It's talked about in one of the Kevin Smith movies, Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back, in which they describe the archetype of a character who is of African-American origin and whose function within a story is literally to prop up the white hero. His job is to be the supportive best friend, to basically resolve any conflict that may exist, any emotional conflict or life conflict that may exist within the typically white protagonist. What you then have here in this movie is a fantastical expansion of this idea that imagines a secret society of black men and women who are given these effectively supernatural powers and sent out into the world to placate white people, effectively, to make the world a better place. Now, I'm doing a poor job of explaining this, so instead, I'm going to let David Alan Greer, in the mentor role of this story, explain this concept to you as he explains it to our hero, Justice Smith, from the Pikachu, Detective Pikachu, and the Jurassic World 2, Fallen Kingdom, that's it. This is him explaining what they do and why.
What's the most dangerous animal on the planet?
Sharks.
White people.
Oh.
When are white people most dangerous?
When they're teamed up with sharks.
When they feel uncomfortable. White people move into a neighborhood, they feel uncomfortable. Gentrification.
Okay.
White cop sees a black man, feels uncomfortable, another shooting. It was a time when all you had to do is look at a white man and make him uncomfortable. That was pretty much it for you.
Yeah, I get that.
The last thing we see in this world is an uncomfortable white man. But I don't blame white people for that. I blame their discomfort. That's why we here at the American Society of Magical Negroes fight white discomfort every damn day.
This sounds like a comedy?
It is a comedy. To be fair, it is absolutely a comedy. It's a fantasy comedy that I kind of owes a debt to something like, you ever see Collateral Beauty with Will Smith? Where you had the three actors who were pretending to be like the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future kind of thing. It was a terrible movie, but this owes a kind of a debt to that in terms of its setup. Now, I actually really liked this. It's a shambles and a mess of a movie, but it's really charming. And the concepts are corker. Like Kobe Leiby, I think, wrote and directed this. I wasn't familiar with their work before. I'd be very interested to see what else they've got in the tank after this. Because, as I say, the concept, absolute corker, which is that's going to be a recurrent theme this week. We've got a lot of very good concepts, but you know, that aren't wonderfully pulled off, or aren't pulled off quite as well as they could be. Now, with this one, you've got a lot of great performances in there. Nicole Byers, for me, is the MVP of this one, as the sort of dean of the College of the Society of Mystical Negroes, the Secret Society, which kind of weirdly reminded me of the Fremen scenes from Dune at a point. But I really like Justice Smith in the lead. I was watching him during this movie and thinking, this guy's had a hell of a run. this past decade. Like, this past, like, for the last, since about 2014, 2015, he's been on a hell of a run. And I'm really glad to see he's gotten some really good roles. And I can see why, because he has a sort of a Jay Baruchel kind of loser-like charm. But at the same time, he's a very likable, charming, investable lead who can pull off sort of action beats when he needs to as well. And here kind of gets what's effectively more of a rom-com kind of a role to play. And there is a sort of romantic subplot to this. I would argue that the movie's a little bit too afraid to tackle some of the ideas that, for instance, that clip suggests. That they come up very briefly, but the movie doesn't quite concern itself with that and goes for more of a Google Office kind of setting for most of its runtime and deals with, you know, a software engineer who really is quite an unlikable character. You can kind of see where the story is going to go. It does feel weirdly like a role that Will Smith would have taken on in the early 2000s, which is kind of funny when you consider that Will Smith in the early 2000s took on the role that literally led, I think, to the creation of this. He kind of is he played one of the 21st century's definitive archetypical mystical Negro tropes. And you get reminded that it was Will Smith in that because of how Justice Smith presents himself in this. The fact they're both named Smith is interesting as well. So not a complete success, but it's inventive and likable and charming, if a little bit shambolic and ramshackle, and maybe a bit too afraid to go too hard on the elements that it really should. The fact that it's rated 12A, I think, is a part of that as well. I think to keep it skewing as young as it is, make it family friendly. There is that. But I will say, I do like seeing, you know, a family-friendly fantasy story on this kind, that has a concept of this scale and grandeur that is aimed at anyone other than Caucasian audiences. So you know what? Two massive thumbs up from that. Like I say, it's a bit wobbly at times. It's a bit fearful of its, I think, of its own concept, admittedly. But fair play. Well done. Great effort.
Well, you can make your own mind up. If you want to go and see the American Society of Magical Negroes, it is out in cinemas from today. All right, let's move on to an animated adventure fantasy, Scary Girl. Who's made this one?
This comes to us via an animation house who I believe are responsible for the video game. This is based on a video game from about 12 years ago that I wasn't overly familiar with. I think it's part of the PS4 generation. I think it might have been PS3. It's Xbox One and PS3, I believe it was on originally. I wasn't overly familiar with it. A young girl, it's a CG animated, 3D animated, as we say now, animated sort of fantasy adventure movie about a young girl named Aki who has a tentacle for an arm. She has a father who is a squid. They live under the sea, and they live their lives providing the local plant lives with light that they have been starved of. For reasons that we don't quite understand, but electricity and energy from the light that keeps the plants alive. And the reasoning for this is because over in the City of Light, the evil Dr. Maybe, voiced by Sam Neill, no less, has in fact been harvesting all the energy and light for himself to power his experiments in order to resurrect his lost daughter. For this, he also needs to secure, via kidnapping, several octopuses, which includes Arky's father, after whom she sets off on an adventure to rescue him under the sea, encountering all sorts of wild and wacky creatures along the way. You've got a voice cast that includes, like I say, Sam Neill, Tim Minchin is in there as well, Anna Torv, who was the lead in Fringe in the 2000s as well. As I say, great big animated adventure. Got a clip for you. This is when she is in sort of a Mos Eisley cantina-like setting and runs into a bevy of other creatures who are all really interested in obtaining someone who has that tentacle.
Why, hello, little girl. Are you lost?
No. I'm just waiting for my friends.
Friends? Oh, we can be friends with you. And with your tentacle.
Let go of my tentacle.
Tentacle? Haki! Ooh, is that a tentacle?
Mind your own business. She's mine.
Yeah, mind your own business.
I'm glad you're the one that has to keep saying tentacle, because I know I'd mess that up at some point.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself that this has been a long time since I was in a bar and he was obsessed with my tentacle. But there we are.
Well, I was wondering if this has got a soundtrack to go with it, because it seems the kind of movie that would have a decent soundtrack. If not, I feel like they've wasted that a bit.
They have wasted that a bit. And it's gorgeously animated. There's a really interesting world that's developed within it. However, and again, I love the voice cast. I think they do a fine job, if a little stilton at times. But the film falls apart on a writing level by being, I think, too convoluted, too muddled, too messy, and a bit too complicated, really, is the term, for under fives, we shall say. Because I think that is kind of the core audience. This is the kind of thing you want to be able to show Albert. It seems like it should be aimed, for instance, at Albert.
Yeah.
He's five, isn't he, Albert?
Yeah.
But then again, it's kind of too unengaging and too muddled and too dull for the adults. So it doesn't really work for either end of the audience spectrum on this one, not for the kids and not for the parents. And I feel like that's absolutely a waste of potential, because you've got great characters, you've got a fine cast, wonderful animation. Like I say, I love the world building to it. It's just the story for me doesn't quite work, and I'm not sure if that comes from the video games. I'm not familiar at all with the video game, let alone overly. So it's one for animation aficionados, like, at best, I would say. But it's not something that's going to linger in the mind. You will forget it not long after you've seen it. I had to refresh myself on the plot before sitting down to do this with you, because it doesn't linger in the old noodle, you know what I mean?
It's a shame, because, you know, a big number in there like Let It Go from Frozen or something, you know, it could have been a massive hit for the under fives.
Exactly, and a movie called Scary Girl. Come on, give me a Billie Eilish bad guy cover or something like that at the very least.
Yes, yeah. exactly that. Well, it's in cinemas from today. If you want to go and see it, maybe pop to the cinema this weekend with the little ones to see what they think. Scary Girl. All right, still to come then, we're going to talk about Ordinary Angels and There's Still Tomorrow in just a minute. Stay there, we'll be back. Hello and welcome back to Off Screen. Right then, two more movies to chat about now to see what Van thought of them. Ordinary Angels in a moment, but let's look at There's Still Tomorrow, which I did say last week, actually, when we discussed it. Sounds like a James Bond movie, but it's not.
It does sound like a Bond movie, doesn't it? Right, so new movie written and directed by Paola Cortellesi, I think her name is. My Italian is not very good, for obvious reasons.
Cortellesi.
Yeah, and now I'm going to point out, this was recommended to me by one of my producers at Talk Radio, Gabriella, who's an Italian lady, who saw this a few weeks ago and recommended it to me. And I love dealing with Gabriella, she's the best. And she's just out of the blue, just said, "Have you seen this film, There's No Tomorrow? Have you heard of this?" I have no idea what that is. She said, "Okay, won't tell you anything about it. It's this Italian movie. I saw it. You've got to see it. It's great." And Matt Turner, a film critic friend of mine, recommended it to me as well. About a week later, we were at a screen. Said, I'm really looking forward to seeing this. Like, you know, are you going? I'm like, no, I don't know about it. I'll request a link. Finally got to watch this, literally this morning. And this is a case of I might have accidentally saved the best for last this week in terms of like watching films. It's up there at the very least. So, right. I say Paola Cortellesi, well, has written and directed this. This is set in post-World War II Italy. It is very much a sort of classic golden age Italian neorealism kind of a story. You know, deals with the poor and working class, that loss of you know, Italian identity post-war, and deals with a mother named Delia. She has two young children and one who is late teens kind of age, who is, you know, about to get betrothed to her boyfriend she's been seeing for about a year. However, Delia herself is dealing with kind of a soulful crisis in the form of this abusive relationship that she's having to endure every day at the hands of her husband, who is an absolute bloody monster. It has to be said. Now, you can tell the film is really well done, because I viscerally hate this man. Right now, just picturing his face makes me angry. It's that kind of a film. And it is about, like, her, you know, her basically grappling with the idea of can she change this scenario? What changes can she make? Can you change a person, or do you have to change your life? And it's, you know, the different elements that come into play. The betrothal between her daughter and the boyfriend brings with it a bit of a class divide, a class struggle. Really fantastic drama. Really something. Black and white, subtitles. I know you're never going to watch this, I know. But, sorry, I know. But if I can't get you to watch The Raid, I don't fancy getting you to watch, my odds on getting you to watch this still tomorrow. But wow, what a drama this was. Absolutely, just completely compelling stuff. It has a very unique tone to it. It's very immersive. As I say, that classic golden age neorealistic, you know, Italiana of it. It's very immersive in that. But at the same time, it's got this cheeky, anarchic side to it that comes out in very strange little ways, little visual flares here and there, and weirdly needle drops. There's a couple of really interesting needle drop choices in there, musical choices that come in as non-diegetically come in. And there's for instance, there is a track by a certain popular early 2000s hip-hop R&B duo that's played in this. I can see the look of confusion on your face. Yeah, it's like that. It's like when they start playing Jay-Z and Gatsby. It's just one of those like, wow, what a brilliant, but what a random choice.
Not Run DMC and Jason Nevins.
Yeah. No, not Run DMC and Jason. Oh. They were 98, incidentally, so late 90s. But yeah,
okay.
They were around in the late, this one I'm thinking of were around in the late 90s, but didn't really hit big until about 2001, I would say. If I just, without naming him, I'll just say Ms. Jackson to you and see if that tells you what you're
talking
about. Oh! Yeah. In a 1930s set, you know, yeah, neorealism, yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. Say, I really love this. Cinematography on this, absolutely stellar. Great performance in the lead from the actress whose name I have absolutely forgotten now. And she was... It was Paola Cortellesi. There we are. So that kind of explains it all. But do you know what it is? Her filmmaker picture looks nothing like how she does as an actress in the film. And I found her performance, really engaging, really captivating, but really sort of inducing, really drawing you in kind of a turn where you really bought into the inner turmoil of Delia's life in this. Absolutely fantastic. I cannot recommend wholeheartedly enough to check this out. Do you want a drama with a kitchen sink drama with a difference? You cannot go wrong with There Still Tomorrow. So I'm going to give this one up to my Talk TV producer, Talk Radio producer, Gabriella, for recommending this, because what a shout, Gabs. Well done. Loved it.
Well, there you go. If you don't mind subtitles and you can get your head around that, unlike me, There's Still Tomorrow is out in cinemas from today. Okay, let's look at Ordinary Angels then. So from what I can gather, this is quite a serious drama.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, it is. So this is the new movie from the not part of the actual Gunn family, John Gunn. So not related to Sean Gunn or James Gunn. I believe there is a third brother as well. This is John Gunn, the not quite a gun. The gun-firing blanks, we shall say. And this is a faith... this is a faith-based drama based on a true story. And believe me, the words based on are doing a lot of heavy lifting here, because the movie itself demonstrates this at the very end. Based on the true story in 1994 of a father who's played for the screen by Alan Richson, who loses his wife and is then given the diagnosis for his young daughter. I think she's about 10 years old. Young daughter. She has a unique condition that's going to require her to have a kidney transplant within the next year, or she's not going to make it. And the average waiting time on the US transplant list at this exact moment, at this point in the 1990s, was 2.5 years. And he, of course, he's a roofer. He can't afford the medical bills he has left over from his wife, let alone the medical bills his daughter is racking up, which are like $6,000 a time. Every time he has to take his daughter for blood transfusion, $6,000, we are told. And, you know, it's America, so they literally give you the bill at the checkout desk. And, into this mix comes Hilary Swank, who is an alcoholic hairdresser in the same small town, who happens to see, she's a recovering alcoholic initially, I believe we're told. She sees the story in the local newspaper, feels just drawn, just feels for the family, but also feels just drawn into the story, and sets out to raise the money single-handedly that can save the young girl. So I've got a clip for you, and this comes from, this is Hilary Swank sitting before the hospital administrators about halfway through the movie, asking for some kind of discount or exemption on all of these extravagant medical bills.
Let me show you something. Ed's daughter made this for school. A family tree. A simple drawing made by a child. How one life leads to another. Or in this case, how one death leads to another.
Miss Stevens, please.
Teresa Schmidt came to this hospital for help. Now, the good doctors did their best to save her, but they couldn't, and she died. Leaving behind a heartbroken husband and a very ill little girl, Michelle. Her treatment costs thousands of dollars a month her family can't afford. Know why? Because after you sent her mama to the morgue, you sent them a bill so high their family couldn't pay it off in 100 years. You realize the message you're sending this girl, right?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, this is about a young girl who potentially is going to die. I obviously don't know if it, that happens at the end. I mean, there is nobody in this world that isn't going to get sucked in by this storyline emotionally attached, involved. I would imagine there's moments of tears, like a proper heartfelt movie, this, by the looks of it.
You'd think that, wouldn't you? You'd hope.
Right,
first of all, I am happy to say that this falls into the category of one of my very favourite kind of movies. The kind of movie that's so hilariously bad that you just have a great time laughing your ass off at it. It is absolute bilge. As for you don't know whether she lives or dies, I will tell you, I did say at the beginning of this review, it is a faith-based movie. So...
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, piece that one together. You know how all these faith-based flicks go? We've all seen God's Not Dead and Soul... God's Not Dead trilogy now, isn't it? And Soul Surfer and crap like that. Right. I mean, I hated it, but I had an absolute blast watching it because I was, honestly, I was sat on my... I was just arms behind my head on the couch, cackling, laughing like a gibbon. It makes up next to no sense. It's a kind of middle-of-the-road Hallmark Channel movie my mum would absolutely adore. I mean, how, in the name of Satan's butthole, you managed to get two-time Oscar winner Hilary Swank to hitch her wagon to this bilge is absolutely beyond me. And I'll be really honest, I've got a conspiracy theory going that there is some sort of secret sex tape of Hilary Swank in existence that we just don't know about. Because it's the only excuse I can find. I mean, still a stone cold fox, better than the material she's given here, but that's not saying much. Then you get to Alan Ritchson. Jack Reacher. You know Reacher from Amazon at the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's playing the dad? Now, again, I can actually see why you might get that guy to do this. Because, you know, based on interviews, his sort of social presence, he seems like quite a family-centric, good values kind of dude. He's into crypto, but we don't really hold that against him. He still makes Reacher. So fair. However, it does fall into that category of like, wait a minute. Are you ever going to explain at any point why this Joe Schmo, average nobody, roofer dad, happens to be Jack Reacher level jacked? Because that makes no... And it sticks out. It's like if you've got John Cena to do it. You know, he's just like abnormally large. You're like, at any point are we going to bring this up? Nah, you're not. He is so much, he's just worth so much better material than this. But then you get to the based on a true story bit. And you know the bit at the end of the end of every one of these when they show you like pictures of the real people and they tell you what happened to them, like how they spent the rest of their lives. There's a bit in the movie that involves a helicopter trying to land at night and all the townspeople rallying around, like trying to make a clear the space in the snow and use their headlights to illuminate, lay blankets so the helicopter can see where it's going. You get to the, and it's this great big moment in the movie, great emotional swell that's meant to make you do the cross gesture on your chest. Oh, thank you, Jesus. That kind of moment. Except it's undone about 20 minutes later at the end of the movie by genuinely featuring the actual helicopter sequence in reality, covered by the local news or camcorder, etc., that takes place in daylight, in no storm blizzard whatsoever, doesn't need headlights, and doesn't feature the town people. You're like, wait a minute. I feel like you're doing based on a true story in kind of the same way that they did for the Amy Winehouse movie last week. So Yeah. I mean, absolute crap. Very televisually directed. This belongs on the Hallmark Channel, which, believe me, is where this will be broadcast at some point. I mean, maybe you'll find this on Pure Flix or maybe even Netflix down the line because it's very much a streaming level movie. But it is, however, so enjoyably terrible that you're going to have an absolute blast. Like I said, just doing what I did. Just sitting back, kicking back and laughing like a gibbon.
Never let a little lie get in the way of a good story. Ooh. That's clearly...
I left out the best bit. This movie is so badly written that this is a faith-based movie that at one point uses the actual track Losing My Religion by R.E.M. That's the level we're playing at, people.
Oh, dear. Well, if you want to make your own mind up, you can go and see it because it's not on Hallmark Channel yet. Ordinary Angels is out in cinemas from today. All right, we've still got challenges to come and we're going to look at Boy Kills World next. Stay where you are. Hello and welcome back to Off Screen. Let's plough straight into our next movie, out in cinemas from today, Boy Kills World. I've just seen a little snippet of the trailer. I've got to say, it does sort of remind me a little bit of Wonka, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, actually.
You think? Well, I mean, the closest thing recently that I could compare this to actually is Monkey Man, of all things. Monkey Man and Guns Akimbo with Daniel Radcliffe, which very few people have seen, and they absolutely should. Daniel Radcliffe wakes up one morning with guns nailed through his hands, being told that people are coming to kill him, and it's absolutely banging. But anyway, beside the point, it's also got Samara Weaving in it, which automatically gets an extra star for me on any movie. But if even you normally watch these things, these trailers on mute as we're talking, and
yeah.
I will say that without the sound, you're going to be missing the key gimmick of the movie. Now I'm going to explain that to you, and you're going to lose your mind over this. So, Bill Skarsgård is Boy, hence the clever title, Boy Kills World. Boy, when he was much, you know, he's Bill Skarsgård's age, he's in his like mid to late 20s, jacked like you wouldn't believe, and a lethal killing machine. He also happens to be deaf and mute because when he was a kid, along with his younger sister and his mum, they lived in a fictional Asian country that's ruled over by a Western crime family who once a year have a night called the Culling, in which they get all of their descenders, all of their would-be rebels in their country, to fight one another to the death for their amusement. His family get caught in the crossfire of this. His sister and mum are murdered, and he is hung with his tongue cut off. So he can't speak. And also, because this has happened so far in the past, the only internal monologue that he has is the voice of H. John Benjamin, a.k.a. Bob from Bob's Burgers and Archer from Archer. Yes. And the reason he has this voice is because one of his last pleasant memories was with his young sister, and they went to a video arcade, like a Street Fighter video arcade, and he was the voice of the commentator on the fighting game. So this is the voice that's narrating his life as he goes on a revenge-fueled killing spree, working his way up to every member of this crime family and offing them one by one. Said crime family, by the way, includes at the very top Famke Janssen, Jean Grey, GoldenEye villain Famke Janssen at the top, the Sholto Copley as the most Trumpian one of the bunch, Michelle Dockery from Downton is in there as well, and last but certainly by no means least, Brett Gelman from, most people I think now know him for Stranger Things. He's in one of the most recent seasons, Stranger Things, but he's appeared in multiple sitcoms and things like that. He's kind of a fan. He's one of those people, if you know him, he's a fave of yours. He's very much that case for me. Now, I should point out one final gimmick before I give you the clip, because the clip does bring this up. Because he is bad at lip reading, and of course the movie is narrated to us by his internal monologue, it's in the first person by the internal monologue by H. John Benjamin, he's very bad at lip reading, so several characters throughout the movie deliver their dialogue in complete gibberish. They deliver the line with complete sincerity, but they say nonsense. So whereas I would say to you, I like your shirt today, I would say, oh, umbrella, beach ball, banana. And that's how it works. And all of this is going on.
Brilliant.
Amidst what's basically the plot of Monkey Man, aka revenge-fueled killing spree. Have a listen.
Dodo bonds for long lamps.
Uh-oh, can't read his lips. Is he mumbling in a different language?
They will, hold on. What about Yamoi? Where is she? Yamoi.
Momo parking lot.
Probably not saying that. Maybe if I concentrate, I can...
Pick up our briefcase.
Something about pickles.
Snookle boom top top.
Are these words? I don't...
Dodo bonds for turn to bird.
Dodo bonds sound fun. Uh-oh. Oh, wait. Dodo buns are not fun. I've never heard a grown man cry. Not sure what it sounds like.
What a brilliant concept. Yeah. I absolutely love this idea.
And you will love the movie too. First of all, it is raw as hell. Nasty AF. It is brutal. Do you remember last year when we reviewed Evil Dead Rise? So about 18 months ago now, we reviewed Evil Dead Rise. I think it was the end of 2022. And I remember saying to you, I'm never going to look at a cheese grater the same way.
Yes.
No, that was child's play compared to what this movie does with the cheese grater. There is an Old Boy style sequence in which Bill Skarsgård literally works his way through a kitchen, taking out eight guys with a cheese grater. And it is one of the most horrifying things I've seen in ages. I'm an absolute blast with this. It's a bit, the components of it, each individual component is amazing. The sum of its parts is maybe not as good as the each individual parts. You know, it falls apart a little bit in the end, but by that point, you're already riding a 4-star wave of energy and enthusiasm and just a vibe anyway that you do not care whatsoever. Like, you know, go off the rails in the final 10 minutes. It's like, I don't really care because you've given me such a good time to this point. There is a death of one of the founding... In fact, it's the very first one of the founding members who dies that he takes out in his revenge spree, who just gets one of the most laugh-out-loud funny deaths you've seen in a while. Like, just an accidental offhand... Like when John Travolta shoots the guy in the face in Pulp Fiction. Like, whoa! Nice! One of those. Just what, oh, I didn't mean to do that kind of deaths. Absolutely brilliant. Loved it. Barrel of laughs. Skarsgård commits to the bit. First of all, that dude is shredded in this. I mean, I don't know how he was looking before. On the movie, he was looking working before this, but damn, that dude is shredded. H. John Benjamin. I'm a big Archer guy anyway. I'm not so much of a Bob's Burgers guy, but I love Archer to death. And his voice is obviously a key part of the fun of Archer, that really sort of deep, booming voice that he has. Really big fan, and he steals the show here. But it's a tough bit of competition for who's stealing that show, because it's a great cast. It's a stacked cast as well. And the name of the actor who plays Mad Dog in The Raid, I can't remember his name offhand, I'm not gonna lie, but he plays the shaman who has raised Boy as a killing machine and has raised him literally literally getting him high every night as part of his like endurance trials. He literally gives him like ayahuasca every night, makes him smoke opium, and we get all the hallucinations, all the everything everywhere all at one style hallucinations that come with that. It's really something. It's one of those movies that's where the
Wonka analogy came from, I think, from what I saw in the trailer. Like, it does look very, I'm assuming that's like with the dancing pineapple. Like, yes. What the hell?
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, there is a dancing pineapple. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. can't bear the lead on that one. There, in fact, is a dancing pineapple in this movie, and it's part of a great sequence, as well, just a larger than life, really rip roaring sequence. Like I say, if you're being academic about it, it does fall apart a little bit at the end, but you don't care because it's not that kind of movie. You're just having too much fun with it, and for how much fun you are having, all is forgiven. Two thumbs up, absolute banger. 4 stars from me, I think. Academically, probably ranks in execution maybe about a 3.5 star, but I'll go 4 to 4.5 stars out of this. I really enjoyed it.
Worth going to the cinema to see then, rather than waiting until it's available.
Yes, get to the cinema and see this. This is where you see this one. See this on the big screen. I don't think it is being shown in IMAX. I wish it was, because the kind of thing I would absolutely bloody love to have seen in IMAX. I mean, one thing, you'd have whiplash constantly from it, but what a ride. You wait until you see this, Mr. Ball. You're going to think all your action movie Christmases have come at once.
Yeah, this one's top of my list now from that review. Honestly, it's really the sort of movie I could get stuck into. So Boy Kills World, out in cinemas from today if you want to go and check it out. Right, one last ride to come. We are going to look at Challengers in just a second. We'll see what Van thought to it next. Hello and welcome back for one last ride on Off Screen then. We are going to look at the movie Challengers, which is out in cinemas from today. I know nothing, zero zilch about this apart from what it says on IMDb, which is drama, romance, sport.
I mean, to be fair, that aptly describes Challengers, to be really honest. Challengers is a new movie from Luca Guadagnino. A particular favourite filmmaker of the Cardigans amongst his film critics, who could not fall over themselves to fillet Call Me By Your Name about 7 or 8 years ago, a movie I detest. Why is it classy when Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer do it, but when Jason Biggs does it to a pie? It's fine when it's a peach and it's Armie Hammer and Timothée Chalamet. But when it's a pie and it's Jason Biggs, that's lowbrow. Get bent. Anyway, so, new movie from Marco Guadagnino. That's my Guadagnino rant, sorry. I will also, just to counterbalance that, I will also say this is, in my opinion, Luca Guadagnino's best movie. Far and away. Like, massively his best movie. Caveat that I have not seen Bones and All, the cannibalism one from a couple of years ago. So, this stars Zendaya, who was in that movie. Alongside Josh O'Connor from God's Own Country and the most recent version of Jane Austen's Emma, and Mike Faced, who I've not really seen anything before. Zendaya is the former tennis champion who's had an injury and has had to give up the game herself, has then married another champion tennis player, played by Mike Faced, and she's trying to get him... He's in a bit of a slump. She's trying to get him back on his game. She's coaching him now. Because obviously, having been a champion herself, she's the perfect coach for him. He trusts her. He loves her. He will go with what her opinion and what she says. And she's trying now to get him out of a professional slump. He just can't seem to be the player that he once was. Something is missing in him. And this happens to coincide with the reintroduction into their lives of her former boyfriend and his best friend, who are both one and the same. Another rival champ, played by Josh O'Connor, who's a bit more of a sort of working class player than the much more affluent Mike Faced. And this love triangle that began many years previous, when Zendaya herself was at the height of her professional power and fame, rears its ugly head once more, as this time it's the boys that have to go head to head, with Zendaya stuck right in the middle. I've got a clip for you, and this is from the earlier timeline. This is when they all first meet, and this is them on the beach just enjoying a beer by the fire and getting to know one another.
I should go. My dad comes looking for me. I'll see you at school, Art.
Wait, are you on Facebook?
What?
He's asking for your number. And so am I.
You both want my number?
Very much so, yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not a homewrecker.
We don't live together.
It's an open relationship.
Also, Patrick has a girlfriend.
I do not. Hey, come hang out with us later. They put you up at the hotel in Flushing, right? We're in room 206.
Want me to come tuck you in?
No. We just keep talking. About tennis.
Good night.
We have beer.
Okay.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel this movie has got something about it that's predictable. Now, just this is how I feel this is going to go. So I feel she's obviously a former tennis prodigy. She's married to the guy who is rich and does really well. Then he has a slump. The ex-boyfriend and his best friend gets involved. She then falls for him. He's the underdog. She gets together with him and the husband gets pushed out of the way.
No, it's not.
Good.
First and foremost, this is way filthier than you think it's going to be. Like, way filthier. Didn't think any of this cast had it in them. I mean, O'Connor, maybe. But the other
not
two...
Not just tennis balls, then.
Yeah, it ain't just tennis balls getting whacked in this one. I'm sorry. It couldn't be helped. I'm sorry. That was terrible. Right.
fantastically shot and realized. The look and the aesthetic of this is absolutely gorgeous. It's also got this incredible score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Atticus Finch, Atticus Ross? I can never remember. Wonderful synth score that powers this. And it's actually kind of tied into the overall aesthetic of the film, of that mood, of that tone, of the adrenaline, the tension in it. But I'll be honest with you, and yes, it is, as I say, I think this is Luca Guadagnino's best movie. Far and away best, but I still need to check out Bones and all, admittedly. But my big takeaway from this, other than the fact that I was actually able to tolerate Josh O'Connor's existence in a movie for like nearly two entire hours, is that I am actually now, probably for the very first time, a believer in Zendaya. I wasn't. I didn't really. She's one of those actresses where she's glamorous and gorgeous on a red carpet. I can't possibly deny it. She's one of the most gorgeous women alive on a red carpet. I did not, however, have much stock in her as a movie star, as an actress, but also as a movie star. A perfectly fine actress, but this she's a star thing wasn't resonating with me. Coming out of Challengers, however, yes, I'm on this train. Yeah, rack them up. Give her all the roles. I think this was lined up to be her big breakout role. I think she was paid $10 million for this. I think I remember reading somewhere. And
wow.
Yeah, I can kind of see that because she is the thing holding it all together. The three performances are all good. And it's all equally good, don't get me wrong. But, and there is like not really much of a name cast outside of like the more relatively unknowns to sort of popcorn audiences outside of the main trio. However, of that trio, it is Zendaya who both narratively and performatively proves to be the linchpin, who is holding everything together, and she's phenomenal in it. Also, I will admit, she really fits the overall filthiness of the movie, I'm not gonna lie. I'll be really honest, I did wonder if this was gonna go in that direction, because I did find myself going into it and thinking into it. Like, I was talking to Zerafilm on the way into this. You've met Zara before. And
Yeah.
I was saying, I don't really think it's going to be anywhere near as filthy as it could be, because quite frankly, Gen Z, who are the audience who are going to turn up for a Zendaya, Josh O'Connor tennis movie three-way love triangle story, are not exactly the audience who sat right with Saltburn, because for them it was too filthy. This is the same audience who generally pop on Twitter every 20 minutes to complain that sex scenes aren't necessary in movies, which is absolute heresy, and you should all be flogged to death. But just to defend cinema for a second, but I actually was genuinely shocked that this did go. They give it up for Luca. The boy did good. The boy really did it. I mean, Call Me By Your Name kind of stiffed out on that, pun intended, did stiff out on that one a little bit. But Challengers, Challengers got some filth. And I was into it. I was really into it. I was watching it going, ooh, this is a hot movie. Okay, I'm down.
Looking at the trailer, I did notice, actually, I don't know if it's just amazing filming or did they actually use real life footage from like American tennis competitions, because it looked like it was real footage in there.
It really does look like it, doesn't it? And I have to imagine there has been, like, you know, I think they have actually just staged it themselves, but I think there has been intercutting of some other matches, like other players.
I could have sworn I saw Anna Kournikova in one of the bits. Like, it looked exactly the same as her.
Anna Kournikova, that's a name you don't hear anymore. Wow, Anna Kournikova.
I mean, she's not in the cast list, so she obviously wasn't in it, but there was a moment when I was like, hang on, is that Anna Kournikova? No.
I think I know the moment you're about, and I believe that is archival footage. I think it has just been transplanted from one match into the next. It's really riveting stuff, though, and like I say, you get into the sports element of it. But I wouldn't describe this as a sports movie. That's the strange thing about it. I would describe this, actually, as an erotic drama. If I was going to call it anything, I think this is an erotic romantic drama that just also happens to be set in the world of tennis, which means that of the two that anyone ever watches, the other one presumably being Wimbledon with Paul Bettany and Kirsten Dunst, this is going to be the one I go back to over and over again. I'm never watching Wimbledon again. Well, sure as hell watch this. So yeah, Challengers, absolutely banging. Do watch ASAP. Really good, really, really solid stuff and a really good time.
Right, out in cinemas from today. If you want to watch it, look for Challengers. Right, before we move on to what we're talking about next week, let's just quickly do a movie of the week. I've got a sneaky suspicion I know what you're going to choose, but what are you going to choose?
I'm definitely going with, oh, do you know what? Just for fun fact, I'm giving it over to Boy Kills World. The only thing,
yes.
The thing that disappointed me most about Boy Kills World is that they used that title and then didn't give a cameo in there to Danielle Fishel, which, to be honest with you, if they'd done that, would have just given it an automatic 5 stars from me, but can't have it all.
Right, well, let's look ahead to next week before we vanish. Red Herring to talk about next week.
Red Herring is a documentary from young British filmmaker dealing with his own terminal illness, which I've yet to watch, to be honest. We've got the new Anne Hathaway Prime Video romance, The Idea of You. That's next week. One that I've been very excited about for a long time and I hear amazing things about is Love Lies Bleeding, the muscle mommy crime thriller starring Kristen Stewart and I think it's Katie O'Brien from Andor. She was the needlessly hot imperial badass lady in Star Wars Andor this past year, which it's got Ed Harris, I think, is the villain. It looks like really something, this, and it's gotten amazing feedback from like other critics I know that saw it and people that saw it at festivals and that. I'm hoping to see that in the next couple of days and give you my own take, as well as last but certainly by no means least, Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt. It's the Fall Guy, baby. The ultimate stuntman movie is finally, and you know how I feel about stuntmen in movies. Like I love a movie stunt, and I've got all the time in the world for stuntmen. I've gotten to know a fair few stuntmen who were based here in Leighton Buzzard, of all things, of all places, who work on the film shoots nearby. And all the film studios are like equidistant to Leighton Buzzard, so they all base themselves here and then just go and work as and well. So they come into the bar wearing like Star Wars Andor hoodies and things like that. One of them came in Avengers Endgame. Why are you wearing an Endgame crew hoodie? Oh, I was a stuntman on that movie. You're kidding me. I'll show you a clip sometime of when the stand-up comedy compare friend of mine, Paul Revel, when he was hosting the comedy night, he literally found this out when he was working the crowd. He got one of them to come up on stage and hit him with a chair. And it was amazing. We filmed it. It was amazing.
Wow. That's an ad hoc evening if ever I've heard one.
Yeah, very few people get consensually hit with a chair. But Paul Revel did.
Exactly.
Yeah. I
imagine the alcohol.
Get what you pay for.
And the alcohol probably helped with that one slightly somewhere along the line. Yeah, great. So, well, I'm really looking forward to hearing more about The Fall Guy next week. Like, that's on my list, as well as Boy Kills World. So, yeah, really looking forward to that. That is, of course, all we've got time for this week, though, on Off Screen. We will be back next week. Until then, I've been Adam Ball.
I've been Van Connor. And like you said, we'll return.